You ready? Okay. 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 Good evening, everybody. Okay, good evening, everybody. I'm happy to see you here. I know time is very critical, so I don't want to delay anymore. I've asked my Rebbe, Omori, Rabbi Aaron Kefet, who I've known for many, many years, to come and introduce the evening, which basically deals with the synthesis of general and studies and Torah studies. And our friendship goes back a long time. He was happy to come, and I asked him to introduce the topic, and then I will discuss pop culture and movies that can help us grow. Now, I don't have to use the mic necessarily, so
there's a very fascinating Gemara in Menachot, Daf Chav Chet Amud Aleph. And the Gemara says, Tana Rabbanan, Kol HaKelim Shasa Moshe, Ksherim Lo, Ksherim L'Dorot. Chatzotzerot, Ksherot Lo, Upaslot L'Dorot. To translate, all the, what we're reading about in last week's Sedra, this week's Sedra, all the various Kelim, utensils of the Beis HaMikdash, Moshe Rabbeinu made them, and once he made them, they are kosher forever. I see their archaeological digs on the way to Beit Shemesh today. If we could dig up some of the kelim of the Beit Mikdash of 2,000 years ago, we can use them tomorrow, Be'ezrat Hashem. But the chatzotzrot, those have to be buried when the leader dies. Kosher for Moshe to use, but it can't be used beyond his tenure, beyond his lifetime. And of course, the question is obvious. Manish Tana, what is the difference? Utensils of the Beit Mikdash, eternal, and the Chatzotzrot, limited in time. The answer, perhaps, is very powerful and very timely. The Beit HaMikdash represents eternity, and nothing changes. This is the way a Jew lives. This is the way a Jew worships. These are the utensils that we use. But the chatzotzrot, the trumpets, look at the Pashat Balotcha, they serve a very interesting purpose to call the people together, to unite Klal Yisrael, to deliver a message, to help us when we go to battle. The leader has to use the chatzotzrot. But times change. People are different. They respond differently. The culture, the society, the civilization, the milieu in which we find ourselves is different than our parents, our grandparents. And the Gemara here is very sharp. A leader has to adjust his message, his method of delivering the message to the people at the time in which he finds himself and finds his people. The chatzotzrot that Moshe Rabbeinu used are not going to be the same ones that the Baal Shem Tov and the Vilna Gaon can use. And the chatzotzrot, the trumpets that they use to convey their message, are not the ones we can utilize today. Well, you talk about movies. Need not tell you, there just was the Oscar ceremony. All you heard on Israeli radio, I don't know about the TV, but every time you turned on the news and they're broadcasting live, I rise early, I turned on the radio, 4 o'clock in the morning, the news and then back to Hollywood. You might think Mashiach is here, such an important event, but this is the generation. This is what speaks to them. This is how we have to deliver our message. And of course, we're gathered here to talk about kosher movies. And I have some students here. Take you back to something that happened in Alon Shvut, in Reb Aaron Lichtenstein's early years here as the great Reb Aaron Rosh Yeshiva, my friend, my colleague, your Rebbe, your role model. You have a PhD in English literature like Reb Aaron. And this happened. I can even pinpoint the date. It was right after the Yom Kippur War. And someone that we all knew died. His wife actually was the secretary of BMT, if you recall, Esther Shechrua. And it was a very small Israel, yet a very primitive Israel. I'm living here 50 years. The old-timers tell me, you think Israel is primitive 50 years ago. You should have been here 70 years ago. But 50 years ago, if you recall where Shaarei Tzedek was, when someone died, they wheeled the body out into Machne Yehuda, and on the streets of Machne Yehuda, they held the funeral. And I'll never forget, we were all standing around, and they were being maspid, this person who died. And right in the middle of their spredim, the Chevra Kadisha came over and told the Rav who was speaking, move on, there's another funeral, move down the block, and here people are walking by with their salim and shopping and commotion, and right in the middle of the funeral, move on, move on, we need room on the street for the next funeral. Well, shortly afterwards, Reb Aaron held what he used to call a press conference. It's not a press conference in the sense of the prime minister answering questions, but Reb Aaron dealt with contemporary issues. And then he took questions, and one wise aleck kid, and remember, we're talking about Reb Aaron Lichtenstein, a Gaon Adir, PhD in English literature, and this kid pops up, and he asks, Rebbe, what do we gain by reading literature? Isn't it Beetle Torah? And of course, between the lines, he's asking Reb Aaron, why did you waste all that time getting a PhD from Harvard? You should have been sitting in Lakewood and learning. And Reb Aaron, never forget the answer, it's classic. Reb Aaron looked at him. Were you at the funeral last week? The kid says, yes. Tell me, you like the way the Chevra Kadisha conducted itself, comported itself? That was Kavod HaMet? Let me tell you, if the Chevra Kadisha had studied Hamlet, they would never have acted that way. Death, be not proud, etc. So there's something to be said for movies and what they tell us. And I just want to mention some of the movies that Herbie talks about. I can add another few. Talk about Gentleman's Agreement. It's a classic movie. And if you're being a mechanech, I've been teaching Torah for 60 years. And my classroom is dynamic. And even this past Monday, I can't go into it now, but I had perhaps my greatest moment in 60 years of teaching. Literally, Gilui Shrina. My wife and I were privileged to bring over 13 young ladies from Odessa for a two-week tour of Israel, Shvat Ami. And I know from the past, whenever we do this, young people wind up becoming Jews, coming in Aliyah, marrying children. 50 years from now, out of this little tour, there'll be hundreds of Jews walking Al Admat HaKodesh. And it was a beautiful program because I arranged with two of my female accomplished students who were born in Russia to address them as well and tell their life story. So, you know, when students have opinions and you accentuates who they are and what they are and what they believe. And sometimes it's important, put yourself in someone else's place. And if you recall Gentleman's Agreement with Gregory Peck becoming a Jew, quote, end quote, and experiencing what anti-Semitism is all about, no WASP can really understand what we go through until al basariya chazenu, I feel it on my own blood. Now, there's one example of a movie with a very timely, important message for a mechanech. Another movie that Herbie talks about, Father of the Bride. Tell me, how many of you are gerer chassidim? How many of you are bava v'chassidim? Do you know what's going on? This is one of the greatest problems we have, to marry off a child, to make a wedding. All right, in the Litvisha world, there are no two ways about it. Every young man learning in Lakewood demands a girl with a father who has a PhD. Papa has dough. There's no two ways about it. The Hasidic world is not so strident, but the expenses. So they have takonet, Ger has it for years already. You're very limited what you can spend on a wedding, how many people you can invite, how big an apartment you can buy for your child. No matter how wealthy you are, you have to fit yourself to the requirements of the community. Bavav in New York, I believe it's Bavav 45, there was, again, we Jews are fabulous when it comes to machlokes. You understand? Though you just had an election campaign in Beit Shemesh. I mean, we had in Yerushalayim. Now there's a national election campaign. If they landed here from the moon and read the newspapers and heard the news, they'd go back to the moon and there'd be a big, big headline. The Jewish people are the greatest bali machlokes since the world was created. We rejoice in controversy, but they just had split legal money, bavav, but I believe it's bavav 45, I saw the takana, that's 5 pages, ordinances, how much you spend on a wedding. Could very well be that the bavav Rebbe of 45, it's 45, 45th Avenue, in Borough Park. There's one Bava 45 and one Bava 48th, and that's their official name now, Bava 45 and Bava 48. Could very well be that the Bava of the Rebbe saw Father of the Bride. Schindler's List. Do I have to go further? Hakorat HaTov. We hear, again, if you know what's going on with the Meir Kahana, they're going crazy, fascist, murderer. He's not here to defend himself. I happen to be standing here because Meir Kahana was my madrich in Bnei Akiva, inspired me, my brother, my wife, many others. He wasn't as bad as they make him out to be. But to non-Jews who risk their lives and saved so many Jews, we owe tremendous hakarat hatov. The Schindler List is a classic movie. I can only tell you, Sempo Sugihara, whenever I mention his name, I say Zeichet Tzadik Livracha. Sempo Sugihara, the Japanese consul in Kovna, Kaunas. How are we Jews today? How do we know how to learn? He saved the entire Mir Yeshiva. I mean, just think what I'm saying. And you can talk about this endlessly. It's a tangible miracle of an unsung hero, a man who later is in Moscow, has to run away, is being punished for what he did, and totally lost. And the ambassador to Russia from Israel, whose parents had been saved by Sugihara, he uncovered him in Moscow years later. Today, of course, everyone knows the name, but Hakorat HaTov, critically important. Let me just go add 2 other movies to the list. 1939, Mr. Smith goes to Washington. Jimmy Stewart, Do you recognize that movie? Tell me, when you see that movie, has anything changed? Ribbono shel Olam, America, politics, democracy, Israel, what goes on here with our politicians? What a classic movie. But that's life. It opens your eyes, and you have to be a better person and a more committed person not to fall into the enticement of power and money and all that goes with it. And finally, again, I come back to Gregory Peck, To Kill a Mockingbird. People consider that the most powerful movie ever made in the history of movie making. But To Kill a Mockingbird, what the Afro-Americans suffered, the murder, the hatred, the enmity, prejudice, how to uproot it from you. And here in Israel, halavai, every Jew here should see that movie. I need not tell you some of the prejudice among us, Ethiopians, Eidat HaMizrach, the Sfardim, the political parties, the Haredi world, part of our world. To Kill a Mockingbird opens your eyes. It's better than 100 Musa talks that you'll fall asleep on. That movie will rivet you, and the message is powerful. So to summarize, there is no question that today our civilization, movies play a big role. We who are the leaders, we who are the machanchim, we who are raising the next generation, the generation beyond the next, in my case, the third generation I'm having influence on, we have to know how to blow the trumpet properly. And finally, let me say to Rabbi Dr. Herbert Cohn, there's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Kuf Hei Amid Bet. B'chol Adam Mitkanei, Chutz Mei Beno V'Talmido. People tend to be jealous. I don't know, at my age, I don't think I have any jealousy. But it's a different story. It's a natural trait. But you're never jealous of your son's achievements, and you're never jealous of your student's achievements. So I want to present the challenge to Herbie. This June, Be'ezrat Hashem, my 9th book will be appearing. I just today gave my secretary all the corrections, and she emailed Beit Shemesh. To me, it's beyond words how you send a 400-page manuscript through an email, but it's a different world. 9 books, some have gone through 4 editions already. All right. If I'm not mistaken, this is your 6th book. Am I correct? 6th book. So let it be said that the Rebbe gives you a bracha. You should catch up with him and overtake him, Be'ezrat Hashem.
Okay, thank you so much for your kind words. The topic is pop culture and movies that can help us grow. When I'm finished, we're going to have a Q&A. So let me just begin. In my graduate studies, I was at Hunter College. I was in the Kola at YU, but I did not know if I was going to be a rabbi or I didn't know what my future was. So one of my rabbis said to me, it was Rabbi Moshe Tendler, as a matter of fact, and he said to me, not to me, but to the entire class, the rabbinate is a very precarious position. Always have something else to fall back on. And he was a rabbi in Muncie. He never received a salary for being rabbi of the shul. He was a biologist, a scientist. All his income was from his secular field. But he always encouraged his students to diversify. So I took a master's degree at night at Hunter College in New York. And one of my professors was teaching me European literature. The particular author we were studying was Rabelais, French author, in translation. Rabelais is known for his profanity. Every paragraph that he writes is filled with four-letter words. So the professor, who was really a wonderful teacher, wanted all the class to feel the power of his language, and he went around the classroom. Everybody has to read a paragraph. So, you know, I'm getting very, very nervous. I'm wearing a kippah. It's a co-ed class. My parents never spoke profanity in my home. I didn't know what to do. And the sweat began to pour as he moved down the row. He came to me, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't read the paragraph. And then he simply moved on to somebody else. In a sense, he was trying to open me up to the world, to secular culture, the highs and lows, and I retreated to my own parochial background. And at that point, I began to think about the whole issue of modern orthodoxy. In a sense, it's an oxymoron. How can it be modern and orthodox at the same time? It's complicated. And then I came across an illuminating Rashi in Bereishis, in the Parsha of Noach, Perek Tet, Pasuk Chav Gimel. It describes what happens after Chum exposes Noach. And you see that Shem and Yefes carry him out. But what Rashi points out is that the verb that is used is singular. It's not plural. So then he explains it was singular because Shem was the one, the son, who initiated the action of covering his father. Yefes was a secondary play. He wasn't the key person. Shem was. And we know from Chazal that Shem and Yefes represent two different worldviews. Shem represents spirituality, spiritual focus, being concerned with spiritual matters. Yefes represents Greek culture, beauty. It represents physical, intellectual beauty, but without a spiritual context. It's external beauty versus Shem that expresses internal beauty. So the takeaway from this is that art has meaning only within the context of a larger Torah worldview. Beauty has to be in the service of spirituality. So if you think about the phrase art for art's sake, it really doesn't work for a Torah Jew. Art has to be for the sake of Torah. Literature has value, art has value, but only to the extent that they enhance our understanding of our spiritual selves. The context is everything. Therefore, how do you translate this approach in terms of, you know, living in the contemporary world? Literature, high culture, and film, which is representative of low culture, they're all problematic. For example, not all literature is appropriate to read. Is it appropriate to read D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover? It's not a simple issue at all, even though he's a fine writer. Because books and movies together present to us images of things perhaps we shouldn't see or read about. Immodesty, unethical behaviors, other unsavory activities. We really should be guided by the biblical model. If you look at Tanakh, what's the biblical model? When dealing with immorality or sexuality in the Torah, the Bible is very brief. It's succinct. The rape of Dinah, the sexual encounter between Yehuda and Tamar, they're dealt with in a few lines. This incident of Pilegesh Begiva, also just a few lines. What the Tanakh is communicating to us is that we should not wallow in observing or reading about immoral or immodest behavior. It's going to exist, we know that. But we don't want to immerse ourselves in it. We want to have our eyes wide open intellectually, but practically speaking, it may be a good idea to have our eyes wide shut on certain occasions. Now, what was the watershed intellectual experience that brought all these thoughts together? It was the first time I heard Rabbi Soloveitchik. I was living in the Heights, in Washington Heights, and I heard about Rabbi Soloveitchik. I was not in his shir, but I heard that he was the intellect, that really was the main driving force for modern orthodoxy. I felt I should go and listen to him. So I decided to come. There were cars double parked, but all I did was walk. I didn't have to worry about parking space. So I went thinking I would stay for a few minutes to get a sense of what it's like. The 15 minutes that I thought I was going to spend turned into 3 hours. But it felt like 15 minutes. It was a wow moment. I've never experienced that in my life before, and I haven't experienced it in my life since. It was unbelievable. The Rav quoted Chumash, Talmud, Shakespeare, Raskolnikov and Crime and Punishment. It was a wow moment in the sense for the first time I saw valuable life lessons, Torah lessons, that were embedded in classic touchstones of literature such as Shakespeare, Milton, Wordsworth, Tennyson. It was an eye-opening, mind-opening experience. And at YU, I was really blessed because soon after that, I entered the shiur of Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, who in a sense, he was sort of almost a mythical figure because we all knew he had a PhD from Harvard, you know, a giant intellect. And it was, you know, a very heady experience for me. I taped every one of his lectures, but his Rameyer asked me if I still had the tapes, but I erased them every day. So I didn't save them because I used to review the shiur at night to simply understand what he said during the day. And I was heavily influenced by what he said and by who he was. I remember I was in graduate school at the time when I was in the Kollel. He was head of the Kollel then. And I was curious about what he thought of certain books I was reading. Now, this is a slight repeat from what I've said in other presentations, so you may know, but some of you may not know. I asked him what he thought of Saul Bellow's novel, Herzog. And he responded, as we were going up in the elevator, that he does not read anything less than 100 years old. He only reads classic literature that has withstood the test of time. And he gave me a point of view from which to view all of literature, because it has to be relevant beyond the present moment, beyond the contemporary milieu. It has to be something that's going to last. And when I was teaching in Magen Avot, one of the students asked me, have I read Harry Potter? I said, I'll let you know in 100 years. I haven't read it yet. Okay, so when I became principal at Yeshiva High School in Atlanta, I first taught Judaic studies. But as I moved along in my doctoral studies at Georgia State, I began to teach literature classes, and I discovered oftentimes that students were more responsive to the poetry of E.E. Cummings than they were to a parsha in the Chumash. And I saw that I could teach Torah perspectives on life through dealing with secular literature. Let me give you some examples. One of the things we taught in my British literature class was Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Anybody read that? Judy, I thought you read. Okay. Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. It's an epic poem about a journey. A knight has many tests and challenges until he finally, in a sense, comes to a higher place at the end than he was at the beginning, a better understanding of his own self. So I compare that to Avraham's journey, leaving home, leaving the familiar to fulfill one's destiny. Any journey in literature is a quest for self-knowledge. So if you look at Avraham Avinu, as he moves through his own tests, he becomes a greater person by experiencing all of these nishonot. Think about Shakespeare. There's a lot to talk about, not just Hamlet, but Hamlet was one. But when I taught the sonnets of Shakespeare, a great line that I remember, love is not love which alters when it alteration finds. That line, for me, changed the way I viewed senior citizens. When I was a young man, I see two old people walking hand in hand, looking fondly at one another, and I said, you know, they don't look the same. They're overweight. The guy doesn't have hair anymore. You know, it doesn't seem like they would have the same, you know, physical and emotional connections. But I was all wrong, because I realized that love is more than what's on the surface. Love is very deep. Shekhar HaChem V'Hevel HaYofi, Eshet Chayil says, beauty is vain, the grace is deceitful. And the idea is that what Shakespeare said is a profound comment about the nature of love. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds. It stays with you. It doesn't change because the physical manifestations of it may be different. Then I began slowly. I was in Atlanta for a long time, so I had a chance. I always felt I wanted to teach and not just be a principal in the office, and I had more credibility with my teachers. So I began to teach a course in art of the film because I always enjoyed movies since I was a kid. And I realized that at that point I was moving from high culture to mass culture, low culture, movies. But the reality is, as Rabbi Rakevin has pointed out, students learn differently nowadays, and a teacher has to adjust to that. And I was happy to begin teaching about movies because I knew that more students were watching movies than reading books. And as a kid, I have very fond memories of going to the movies with my mother. I was not reared in a fully observant home. We would go on Saturday mornings to the synagogue, and in the afternoon we'd go to the movies for a double feature. You know, that was like normal life for me, and I enjoyed sharing time with my mom, and also enjoyed the movies as well. They took me away to faraway places and to adventures that stimulated my young imagination. But as I began to get older, which was, you know, 13, 14, I had a, you know, I was in public school, but my rabbi of the synagogue was influential here. I began to get more religious, and especially in the 60s, movies took a very different turn. Movies began to be controversial. Films like The Graduate, Bonnie and Clyde, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. It wasn't Gary Cooper in High Noon, you know, where the good guys and the bad guys are clear. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Paul Newman and Robert Redford. I was rooting for the bad guys, you know? And these were the guys, you know, who captured my imagination. It was a different world. But as I saw movies, I wanted, in a sense, to learn from them. I didn't want to be only entertained by them. I wanted to be educated by them. I wanted them to teach me something. I wanted to be enriched with some life lesson or some message after seeing a film. I began to see this even in the 50s. Two influential films. Again, I might have mentioned it before, but you probably forgot. Are the Defiant Ones, starring Tony Curtis and Sidney Poitier. Black and white film, two prisoners on a chain gang. I was living in Mount Vernon, New York at the time. It's my hometown. And there was tension between blacks and whites in the city because there was a white high school, primarily for white students, who went out to college, and a student primarily for blacks that taught vocational skills. And there was a movement in the community to have one Mount Vernon High School, not the two separate ones, which would mean blacks and whites are coming together. So it was something I was thinking about as a teenager. When I saw the Defiant Ones, these two men who are in a prison, they're on a train. And the train crashes, and these two men escape. One is black, one is white. There's only one problem. They're chained together. They hate one another. They can't stand one another, but they have to learn how to live with one another. So that's a profound lesson. Again, if you don't mind black and white movies, it's worth watching. Another important film for me was The Incredible Shrinking Man. I'll just tell you simply, it's a story about a man. He's on a boat. He passes through a radioactive cloud. The day after he passes through, he begins to get smaller. He gets smaller and smaller and smaller. He's living in a dollhouse one day. The cat comes in, he falls, he barely escapes with his life, he falls down into the basement, and he continues to get smaller and smaller, and a spider comes and is about to attack him. You can see that on YouTube. They have that scene on YouTube, him fighting the spider. The last scene of the film, it's a spoiler, but you're not going to watch this anyway, probably. So he looks up at the sky, and he's like a speck, and he says, "At least in God's eyes, I count. A profound lesson. You know, horizontally, size matters. But vertically, vis-a-vis Hashem and you, the size doesn't matter. It matters what your connection is to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, I'm going to share with you just a number of films that exemplify a kosher movie as I have defined it. And I define it as a film that has something meaningful to say about life, that can help us navigate life. And the truth is, if you don't go to movies, I'm not suggesting you become a movie fan, because movies nowadays are largely corrupting. They're very bad. But if you do go, I can direct you to films that are, I think, worthwhile to see. Three movies that I'll mention that are mentioned in Volume 2, which I didn't talk about before. One is Changing Lanes. The second one is Nebraska. And the other one is Raiders of the Lost Ark. Now, Changing Lanes is a story about two guys who have to be on time for an appointment. They're in New York. Their car gets into an accident on the FDR Drive. For those of you who are in New York, that's the East River Drive. And it's a very hectic, thoroughfare. So they collide. One guy is a lawyer, and he has to deliver a file to the court for a customer who's, you know, a $1 million customer. He really has to get it there. It's a big issue. The other guy has to be in court in a custody hearing. And if he doesn't get there on time, he'll lose custody of his kids. They crash. The lawyer says, I'll pay. Here, just take money. I got to go. The guy says, no, I want to follow the protocols of what you do in terms of reporting an accident, because I may get in trouble. And he's worried about it. He's black, the other guy's white. That's another level to understand here. So the guy goes away. The black guy goes to the court hearing. He loses custody of his kids. The white guy realizes that he dropped the file that he needs at the scene of the accident. And the other guy picked up the file. So he needs the file back quickly. And what happens is an escalation of anger, because there's a great line, which to me made this, for me, one of the best Cohen movies. It's a very dramatic film. But the guy who lost his children, he says, "I'm not just angry, but you caused me to lose my time. And my time I cannot retrieve. I'm late, and I'm paying a big price for this." His wife thinks he's a derelict. He's not serious about taking care of his kids. It leads to all sorts of emotional, you know, contradictions and as they say in Hebrew, agmat nefesh. It's really very difficult. So just to see how this is resolved, and fortunately it is, I think is a film that has a lot to teach us about not letting anger become like an avodah zarah and losing our focus in life, and also the importance of time. Nebraska is a beautiful film to teach kibbutz av va'em. It's a simple story. An elderly father lives in Montana, and he wins a bogus sweepstakes of $1 million. Everybody knows it's ridiculous. But he goes to his son and says, "I want to go to Nebraska to pick up my winnings." So the kid has a choice. He can say, "Dad, I'm not going." Or he could say, "I'm going to stop what I'm doing. I'm going to take him, even though I know there's nothing there." So he goes on a road trip with his dad. And to see the extent to which this son tries to take care of his father is just a beautiful image that I think has value for a Torah Jew. Raiders of the Lost Ark, which you've probably seen, there have been many sequels. Yeah, fun movie. You know, yeah, it's, so what's the message there? You know, there's a statement in Proverbs. Sheva pam yipol tzadik v'kam. 7 times a righteous person falls and he gets up. And his failure is not terminal. Now, Indiana Jones is not a tzaddik. He's just a comic book hero. But what happens in that movie is that every 15 minutes, he's involved in a situation where you think he's going to die. And somehow, he overcomes it, and he keeps on, you know, doing what he has to do to ultimately be successful. So that's a beautiful, image of recognizing that we have to keep on striving to succeed, even in the face of disappointments and failure. I'm working on Volume 3. Somebody asked me if I was working on Volume 3. I am. And I have some films in that as well already, one of which is The Elephant Man, a story about a disfigured man. It was also a stage play. And Wonder, which deals with a disfigured child. There's a famous story in the Gemara, in the Tanit, Daf Chaf Amud Beis. It's a story of Reb Elazar, who was greeted by an ugly man. And for some reason, Reb Elazar didn't seem to exhibit a lot of sensitivity. He says to the man who greets him, "Are all people in your city as ugly as you?" And the man says to him in response, "Go to the craftsman that made me." So Reb Elazar realized, well, how insensitive I was. I mean, the truth is, I'm not in charge of what happens to a person's looks, how he looks. A powerful lesson is, "Al tistakel bakan kan ela masha betocho." Don't judge somebody by what you see, but by what is inside. The film Wonder, which deals with the disfigured child, is a beautiful line said by the principal at a school assembly at which the disfigured kid, his name is Augie, is present. And he says, "Augie cannot change the way he looks, but we can change the way we see." What a line. Oh, for me, it was a powerful line, and I just thought it was, as Rabbi Rakevitz said, it's worth a thousand Musa Shmusin. And it just means a lot. Now, many of you were here for the my OIM talk a few years ago, so I don't want to tell you the same stories. But I'll tell you one, okay? In the books, they're divided up by theme. One of the sections is, adversity, and one is relationships. In the relationship section, I dealt with a film called Splendor in the Grass. Now, the line of Splendor in the Grass is taken from a poem by Wordsworth. which, and I'll quote the lines, though nothing can bring back the hour of splendor in the grass, of glory in the flower, we will grieve not, but rather find strength in what remains behind. Similar message. Failure is not terminal. Disappointments happen. Life goes on. Why did this story have particular relevance for me? Because I remember when I was in ninth grade, I was dating a girl. I was thinking, nowadays you got to be careful. So I won't say her name, but I still remember it. And I thought I was going to marry her. Because, you know, in the 1950s, you know, you dated seriously, even if you were young. So I lived in Mount Vernon. She lived in the Bronx. So I would take a subway there, and I was dating her, you know, in my own innocent way for, you know, several months. And then I decided I'm going to go there and surprise her one Sunday. So I took the subway, and I went, and I surprised her. I knocked on the door, and she was there with another guy. And I remember, it was at that point, it was one of the saddest days in my life. I was in tears. I had to go home. I couldn't stay. But it was, for me, you know, an idea that, you know, I was going to marry this girl, and now she rejected me. I was only 14, but still. So my point is, the poem, when I saw this film, Slim and the Girls, which I saw many years later, it's a story of two people who are destined for one another, and yet they don't marry. Life intervenes. They both go on a different path, and this poem is read to the students while they're in high school, and then at the end of the film, there's a voiceover. They're both, in a sense, going in opposite directions. Both have made peace with the fact that life isn't working out the way they thought. But this poem, you know, the hour of splendor and grace is not here, but life goes on. We have to still somehow make it worthwhile. So I will say now that I'm here to talk about movies if you want. One thing I wanted to tell you, if you want to see a film and you're not sure about whether a film is appropriate, you should consult the IMDb website. IMDb means Internet Movie Database. They have a parental advisory. So they will tell you exactly how many curse words there are, if there's violence, sexuality, nudity, anything. They'll tell you ahead of time. So you can ask yourself, is this something I want to see or something I want my, you know, family to see? So that's always very helpful. If you want a list of movies with Musser messages, I have cards here you can take. Write me an email, and I'll send it to you online so you can have copies of films that I think have something worthwhile to say. If you want to see more film reviews, you can check out my website, koshermovies.com. My quote-unquote bracha to you is, may your movie going not only be entertaining, but enlightening as well. There are three books for sale, Walking in Two Worlds, which deals with high culture, literature, and Torah studies. That's 50 shekels. Kosher Movies, Volume 1, that's a hardback with all the essays in between each section, which explains why I chose to write on these particular topics. Kosher Movies Volume 2 is 50 shekels, and that doesn't have the essays, and it's a little bit more user-friendly, because I wanted to make it user-friendly for teachers. It's all alphabetical, but in the back of the book are the same topics with the films listed under them, realizing that films don't always have one message. They often have more than one, and at least you have an idea of what it's about. I want to thank Rabbi Rakefet for coming and for sharing my moment in the sun. And the books are available, and there are refreshments outside. And I think my son Benjamin is around. He's here. He's visiting me here. Hebrew University sent him here, or they brought him here, because he does their social media for the Einstein Archives, and it's Einstein's birthday. So I get the benefit of having him around for a couple of weeks. So he does it. He works for a website called he's an editorial director of From the Grapevine, which, believe it or not, deals with Israel news that has nothing to do with politics and religion. It's a blank website. Right, no content. Yeah. So thank you all for coming. And if you have any questions, please ask. Please ask. Okay, you can ask him privately. Okay, thank you all.